Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting 3 matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Welcome to the Flat Chat podcast with me, Stuart Codling, powered as ever by F1 Racing Magazine, and joining us in the salubrious environs of the Hotel Hungaria in Budapest city centre, two of our star columnists. We have on my left, I don't know why I'm doing this Nicholas Parsons presenting Just a Minute style thing, but to my left, a man with more stories than the Shard, Mark Gallagher.
Hello, nice to be here again with you.
And opposite, a special guest drafted in to replace Jimmy Roberts owing to our tech failure last week. Jimmy not here. Another one of our star columnists, the F1 analyst, Ed Straw.
Hello, yes, it's nice to be loaned in from the Autosport podcast. I don't have to present, I can just sit here and not contribute much.
And let me do all the nonsense.
Exactly.
Actually, this is quite, and Mark, you'll appreciate this being a connoisseur of certain styles of nonsense. This is a little bit like that famous crossover story in Magnum PI and Murder, She Wrote, where amateur detective and crime novelist Jessica Fletcher went to Hawaii and helped solve a murder.
I never saw that episode. Have you
how
got
how
it?
Did you not do
Have
that?
You got that episode?
I'm sure if you look it up on YouTube, it's there. But yeah, because I often appear on Ed's podcast, and Ed is now appearing on my podcast. So does that make me Magnum and you Jessica Fletcher, or the other way around?
That's what I was just wondering. I think I'm not sure either of us qualify, obviously, for that.
Well, enough of this bilious nonsense. Now, this weekend, we're looking forward to the Hungarian Grand Prix, and we've just dropped a new edition of F1 Racing Magazine on the news shelves. Subscribers will have had it for almost a week now, and on the cover, we investigate Renault's spending in Formula One since they came back. We put it in the order of $1 billion, and as we speak, they're currently sixth in the Constructors' Championship. So I suppose the question is, what's gone wrong? Spoilers, it's an awful lot of money invested in a team that was a little bit behind. But also, what we found in our deep dive, and some of the senior people in Renault have admitted, that it kind of the problem goes back to 2007 when Flavio Briatore thought, oh well, engine homologation's come in, I can get rid of most of the people who make the engines.
I don't buy into that sort of excuse. 2007 is 12 years ago. There's been a lot of water under the bridge and a lot of money spent since then, and I think I think what's a much more realistic view to take is that when Renault took the team back from Genie Capital and set out on what they said was a 5-year plan, it couldn't really be a 5-year plan because the first year was going to be a complete mess because they effectively were using an older car that had, you know, had been designed for the Mercedes engine, and it does take years to get into championship winning position. You know, Red Bull bought Jaguar in November of 2004. They won their first world championship in 2010. That's 6 years down the line before they won their first title. It does take longer. Look at Mercedes-Benz. So I think, you know, to me, the real story is that since they retook Enstone back, they found it being a longer curve to get back into some shape, and then on top of that, they are clearly lacking in some areas, and those fixes haven't yet been put in place effectively enough. So there's a huge amount of work still to be done. So it's maybe not as bad as some people think. There's very clear indications that they still remain flawed in terms of some of the technical solutions, and there's no question the team just doesn't have the money to compete at the front.
Which is weird when you've got, when you've spent $1 billion, we're almost into Dr. Evil money now. Ed, in your capacity as Grand Prix editor of Autosport magazine, you've reported on the ups and downs, mainly downs of the team over the past couple of years. What's your reading of the situation? What do you think has actually sort of held them back year on year?
Well, I think Mark's hit upon a few important points there. I think we do have to look at the first year as year zero. They're trying to do it on less money than everyone else. And unfortunately, no matter how much you talk about efficiency and being cleverer than others, money does create your opportunity. It doesn't guarantee you deliver, but it does create your opportunity. If Mercedes does a 100% job, if Ferrari does a 100% job out of what they've got, then Renault will be behind, even if they do the perfect job for what they've got. Remember, of course, Mercedes had to make a decision to up their investment significantly, even after they'd started this works team, because they realised they couldn't do it on the cheap, in inverted commas. They weren't exactly cheap, but they really had to up their game. And if we look at Renault in terms of their performance, they've kind of flatlined over the last few years. They're a little bit better this year than in the last few years in terms of their relative gap to the front, although other teams are stronger, so they're still struggling to be fourth best. But they're kind of butting up against the sort of midfield glass ceiling. And there is a kind of technical step change that gets you to that level, because the level of research and development understanding that the top teams have got, hugely complicated areas, particularly front wheel wake, how that impacts the aero of the car when you've got lock-on, etc., controlling the aero centre of pressure. All these things require huge amounts of research and understanding that all the other teams have long since banked. So that's a challenge in itself. But I think the whole project is a little bit flawed, because I think if you're going to try and do it 15% less than everyone else, then basically you are gunning to be third or fourth. Perhaps the ceiling for what they can do on that is to become a fourth best team, kind of just off the back of the top three. So it's very difficult for them. And of course, Daniel Ricciardo found when he went there that this difference between what Red Bull could do in terms of the performance of the car, particularly when it came to in the braking and turning phase and the control on that, he just had to dial it back with Renault. It took him a few races to adapt to that. So I think that's kind of a physical manifestation of this gap. And I don't think Renault have done a perfect job with what they've got, but it is also phenomenally difficult for them to make that stride forward.
I think another point we made in the cover feature is pretty much what you said there, Ed, which is that around about, what, 2010? Yeah, 2010, when Ross Brawn engineered the sale of his team to Mercedes, it was kind of done on the understanding that Formula One would be adhering to the resource restriction agreement that Max Mosley planned to be in. And then, of course, that didn't happen because the various parties either were stitched up or stitched each other up, so they had to double down and spend to succeed. And ultimately, Ross Brawn wasn't around to see the success he'd engineered, because he kind of got manoeuvred out just before they started to become successful.
But I think that's what's really important there is that every manufacturer that comes into Formula One sooner or later has to reach a point where they either spend what it takes to win or they get out and do something else. And when you consider that Renault are sixth in the Constructors' Championship, so they're in the bottom half of the table, behind Toro Rosso currently, following the podium for Daniel Kvyat, Honda have come back into Formula One, not as a team, but as an engine supplier, and are getting quite a lot out of that now with their partnership with Red Bull. So Renault, having decided being an engine supplier doesn't do enough for us, so we're going to have our own team back again, then don't spend the money that needs to be spent in order to do the job that you need to do in order to win. And exactly to the points that Ed made, if you're behind the eight ball in terms of budget, it means that if you're doing, let's say, eight parallel development programs, Mercedes will be doing 14. And that means Mercedes can afford to fail at a number of developments, and you can't afford to fail at any. So it puts huge pressure on the team. And this ultimately, I think, is the question that needs to be asked. Will Renault just eventually decide we've got to go for this and throw the money in? Or will they decide, actually, we've been back in Formula One, it's a bit difficult, we don't really want to spend Mercedes level money, we'll just bow out?
I think you make a very good point there as well, the being an engine supplier, didn't deliver, and they admitted that it didn't deliver them the collateral they wanted, because the partnership with Red Bull delivered a lot of world championships, but Red Bull always played their involvement down, didn't they? They said, we've got a great chassis, quite a moderate engine.
To be fair on that, if you look back to that period, 2010 to 2013, you'll see people like Adrian Newey and Christian Horner talking up the contribution of Renault when it comes to exhaust blowing and that kind of thing. So I actually think there's a little bit of that. I mean, Red Bull were the team, so of course they'll get some credit. But also, it's down to what Renault does with what it does. Renault needs to communicate what they're doing and kind of, if you want to use that, to activate their investment themselves. So I've got a few concerns about that, because also, when they launched the works team, they were not quite failing as an engine supplier, but they were struggling. They were kind of the third best engine supplier. So you have to look at yourselves first, I think, before you start saying, oh, well, we're not getting the credit for this, that and the other, because they've basically tried to solve the problem of underachieving on the engine side by creating a works team, which creates a whole extra load of stuff to do, and then underachieving with that, if you like.
So, Ed, you've completely hit the nail on the head there, because Renault, it was within their domain to leverage their four world championship successes for Red Bull. You don't sit back saying, when are Red Bull going to promote us? You put them, again, you put the money behind a coordinated global marketing campaign. I experienced this before. It's amazing when you ask people which engine powered Michael Schumacher's first world championship title. So many people think, oh, was it Renault, Benetton? It was Ford. And then Ford forgot to leverage that. They didn't do anything with it. And no one knew that Ford was powering Michael Schumacher to his first world championship success in the years that followed. So it's down to manufacturers to get their game sorted, to get their ducks in a row. And there is a tendency when manufacturers are an engine supplier for their global marketing people to go, oh, we only supply the engine, so we can't do much with that. Of course, the reality is you can do as much as you want with it. You can take out full-page ads in newspapers. You can run up TV campaigns. You can say, look, we are the power behind the team. Red Bull couldn't do anything about that to stop it. I think the Red Bull-Renault thing didn't deliver them, not because of image. I think it didn't deliver them because there were relationship problems already beginning, and they just didn't like the fact that they were beholden to Red Bull for the car.
I remember from my time working on a magazine done on behalf of Toyota that a lot of the marketing people really didn't understand what was going on with it and didn't really know how to leverage it. And this is a classic case of a manufacturer who comes in, spends a lot of money, hasn't really got an idea what they're doing. And I kind of got the impression towards the middle and end phase of Toyota's involvement that actually the marketing people just wished the whole thing would go away because they didn't know what to make of it. And I suppose you've probably got a little bit of experience in this, haven't you, Mark? Because you came in at the end of Jaguar Racing when Ford had hit that point where they wanted to get rid of it and move it on to someone else.
When a manufacturer decides to check out, it's like when an employee hands in their resignation letter and has 3 months still to run, they're gone. You know, you may as well say, just leave now. Don't worry about it any longer. I mean, I joined Jaguar under Tony Purnell with a view to the team being sold. I spent, weirdly, 2 months of my life in China attempting to pull together a deal to sell Jaguar to a Chinese automotive company, which was something that Ford were quite keen to pursue. So the reality is that, you know, when Ford decided to get out, all the energy had dissipated. There was nothing behind Jaguar Racing in that final year in terms of momentum. It's interesting the way when we look at Mercedes-Benz dominance in Formula One, they've learned so many lessons from their own mistakes in the past and also watching other manufacturers. The Mercedes-Benz Formula One team is run as an autonomous entrepreneur style Formula One team, you know, almost old school in terms of it's out there doing its own thing. It's got Mercedes full backing, but it's not answerable to Stuttgart. They're not having to go running to Stuttgart every time they need to spend a bit of extra money. Toto goes and finds the money, or they have their own budgets. They are masters of their own destiny. And with Renault, you really have the sense that it's answerable. And that degree of being answerable, it ties one hand behind your back.
There does seem to be an element of also then having to justify with results. And then as soon as you're worried about that destabilizes how you're approaching things. You start on when you're working on race weekends. They've had a lot of race weekends where they've been a little bit all over the place with setup. You almost feel like they're trying too hard because they're focused on, oh, well, we've got to be fourth or whatever. It's actually, well, actually, you've just got to work through your process and get the car as good as you can do and then see where you end up. So I think that is a problem. And that actually, that I think you're right, that model that Mercedes has got, which is Mercedes is almost a sponsor of the team and lets the team just really get on its own, is a huge, huge benefit. And I guess actually, you know, Jaguar was mentioned. Well, I deal with Gary Anderson a lot for Autosport, and he was there at the start of Jaguar, and they went from Stewart, which was a team that was probably overachieving, morphed into Jaguar, and then suddenly there was loads of interference from the top level, and just things were being done that distracted from being a race team. And so that is a problem for Renault.
I noticed when I started working with Tony Purnell at Jaguar was the extent to which every month an entire level of senior management were effectively preparing for the big meeting in Detroit, where you basically went and sat at the end of a long table and justified your existence. This is infamously where, on one occasion, I think it was Bill Ford Jr. said, "Who is Eddie Irvine? I don't see him around the boardroom table, and he seems to earn the most of anyone in the company." And they had to remind him he was actually their Formula One driver. So, you know, those kind of conversations really kind of illustrate the point, the disconnect, but also the amount of time and energy then the management are taking up justifying their existence, and that is soul destroying. So I think from that perspective, again, it's weird that Renault didn't learn from the fact that when Benetton was run by Flavio, you know, and then he effectively ran the Formula, well, he ran Renault Formula One, but the Benetton and then Renault transition, that organization stood on its own feet. Flavio brought the sponsorship in, did the deals, ran it. He wasn't answerable to anybody. And by the way, he would have given as good as he would have got from anybody at Renault. And so that independence and that entrepreneurial flair that a Formula One team needs to be allowed to have to get on with the job of just delivering in this relentless battle that we have in Formula One, that just hasn't been the case with Renault in its latest evolution.
We should just say, though, I mean, we've been quite negative about Renault there, and I think there's plenty to criticise them for, but it is also phenomenally difficult. That's why everything has to be so right, so correct, so focused, well-funded. Everything has to be correct to have any chance of getting up to those top three. The level is sky high. And they can't even look to cost capping to bring it back, because that doesn't affect historic spending. It's like if you've got a house, or let's say two of us have got houses, I then spend 500,000 on improving my house, and then suddenly we say you're only allowed to spend 1,000 a year on your house. Well, I've already spent all that, so you build to a higher level. So in some ways that actually could play against a team like Renault if it gets to the point of the board having to decide whether they A, pull out as a team, or B, up the investment. They might be in an arena where upping the investment is a less powerful tool anyway, so they get kind of stuck in this situation.
Depends on how big your house is in the first place as well, doesn't it? I think, well, we're going to have to come round Ed's multi-million pound mansion to watch the next Grand Prix. Now, there's going to be an amusing little Easter egg in some of the audio we've got coming up in a little while, apropos spending and focus, because one of the other features we've got in this month's mag is about a road car. And it's something that it's a conversation we should really have been having a few years ago, because in 2014, Formula One went to an entirely new powertrain package, hybrid with, you know, we'd seen kinetic energy recovery system before, but these were altogether much more sophisticated, particularly with the new MGUH, which is something that we just haven't seen. You would think Formula One would be shouting about the virtues of hybrid power a little bit more loudly than it has done, rather than allowing it to become a problem. And also, you would think that it would smile a bit more favourably upon road car manufacturers who are trying to embrace that. And this month, I was lucky enough to be invited to the Salzburgring to watch basically the first time a car with a Formula One style powertrain has actually hit the track. And even that is just a prototype. So coming up, we're going to be listening to Tommaso Volpe, who is Infiniti's head of motorsport, Cyril Abitbol, who turned up to watch it be driven and to be driven round by Nico Hülkenberg, who we'll also be hearing from. And you'll hear in my conversation with Cyril that he offers, entirely without me probing him on it, that Renault Sport's involvement in the Infiniti Project Black S project doesn't detract from the F1 effort. So, Tommaso, let's set the scene for our listeners. We are actually in the cockpit of the Infiniti Project Black S, which is kind of your brainchild. It was over a dinner and a handshake with the design director.
Exactly, it all started with this nice dinner. That for me, it was very nice. For Matt, maybe it was actually not that nice, because he realized that we were asking him to do the first design concept within 3 months, really, because it was beginning of December, and we wanted to display this car at Geneva Motor Show the same season, so it was really after 3 months. And it all started this way. The idea was very simple as idea, but complicated to deliver, which is, as Infiniti, we co-developed the hybrid technology in the Formula One car, in the Renault Formula One team, and we just wanted to apply the same concept, the dual hybrid technology, to our Infiniti Q60, and which has the only commonality with Formula One car, there is the a V6 turbo engine, B-turbo compared to the Formula One powertrain, but V6. And this is the only commonality. The rest, obviously, is totally different. And also the V6, as you can imagine, is a totally different dispatchment. Yeah. Totally different.
Might share a firing order, but apart from that...
exactly, really, and it moves. Yeah. And it has four wheels, and it moves. So, yes, so this was the idea, and Matthew, obviously, was super excited despite the challenge. And but what was like the big journey we had to go through... At that time, we didn't even know, to be honest with you. We didn't realize how complicated and complex would have been the journey, so to arrive to this point where we have finally the prototype, the running prototypes here in Salzburg.
Well, I suppose that leads us on to the very pertinent question of, is that why it's taken so long, considering it's now 5 or 6 years since... you know, the hybrid turbos came in to Formula One on kind of on the promise that it would lead road car technology, and yet this is, to the best of my knowledge, the first road car, and it's still a prototype that actually has an MGUH, brake by wire, all the gizmos that came into Formula One in 2014. How challenging has it been to make those work in a road car format?
Yeah, well, it took time to take this decision, because as Infiniti we started to work on the hybrid technology in Formula One only from 2016, before we were in Formula One but as a sponsor. And so this decision came in 2017, and it took time to actually deliver it. As you said correctly, the reason is that the technology is very intrusive, is very sophisticated and intrusive into a normal car. This is the first example of this technology applied into an homologated existing vehicle, which doesn't even have the normal hybrid technology.
Yeah.
So it doesn't even come with the normal hybrid technology, this model. And it's very complicated. It's complicated starting from the physicality of it. So you start having the issue on where do you actually put three additional motors, because you have two MGUHs and one MGUK, so three, not two like in Formula One, batteries and inverters. And you start with the problem, where do I actually fix all these parts? Obviously the MGUH has to be in connection to the turbine of the turbo system, but then the car is very busy on the front. And then the MGUK, we decided to put at the rear, so we add the electric torque to the rear wheels, and the car is a rear wheel drive. But then we had to decide to put it on the back of the differential, because we didn't want to add the extra torque to the shaft and changing the gearbox as a consequence. So all these decisions came one after the other, and all present all sorts of challenges in terms of weight, in terms of engineering solutions. The MGUK, to fix the MGUK, we had to cut a little bit the body of the car, then we had to make it stiff again, adding some metal around. And then you have the issue of where to put the batteries and the inverters. Then we decided to get rid of the rear seats.
This is where the passengers would be, isn't it?
Exactly, and then we put the inverters behind this lovely carbon fiber cover, and on and on. And not last, the issue of keeping all these parts cooled, and which is a big issue actually. You can see the car if you compare it to the normal Q60 that has much more air intakes and everything is more open. This is because most of the additional parts are air cooled, and we need a lot of air to actually cool all these parts. So weight distribution that actually improved a lot compared to the Dondor car. So you have all these issues coming one after the other, which we wouldn't have had if we were starting from scratch with a brand new product. So yeah, it was a complicated journey.
I love the way it's got these Formula One style kind of cooker knob parameter controllers here, where you can change the ABS settings, the engine management,
traction control and launch control.
From memory, I don't think Nico adjusted the traction control that much when he did the lap with me, and he fiddled with the ABS a bit, but he was quite enthusiastic about the fact that you're able to play with the engine management modes and you can control the harvesting and the deployment. He said that's a lot like what he has in the Formula One car.
Exactly, this is the main thing actually. I mean, apart from the power delivery, which is the first objective, you want to have a more performing car. The other thing we wanted to replicate from the Formula One experience is the complexity and the sophistication of the system in the way you can manage the energy. So it's not just about recovering more energy because you recover from braking and from acceleration, the gases and the turbines, but also what do you do with this additional energy? It's not in one mode only. So we have actually three modes to drive the car if you want. One, we will now, you see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I mean, it's obviously the switch is on numbers, but the way we call it internally, one is so-called the street mode. So is what we want to ideally set up the moment we want to drive the car in street, maximizing efficiency. The other one is the race mode, so where you can actually have high performance, additional performance, but sustainable performance. So we don't want to have an hybrid car that delivers the hybrid additional torque for one lap and then the system has to recover and to recharge. We want to have a sustainable performance for at least 5-6 laps, depending on the track, of course.
Cyril, what does this moment mean to you in terms of, you know, the whole Renault Nissan alliance and actually making Formula One style hybrids something that happens on the road?
Well, it's an important milestone in the life of a quite an important project. It's a project that started pretty much 2 years ago, but really started concretely 18 months ago. It's a project that's aiming to bringing Formula One technology onto the road for the first time. It's a project that would see also the realization of the decision made by the sport to bring a new power unit regulation in 2014, being more relevant, being more fuel efficient, to make it real and concrete for not just for professional Formula One drivers, but for you, me, and any customers willing to experience the thrill of this type of technology and performance, either on daily drive or at track close to the house. So it's a great project. It's a very exciting project. There is always a risk of a distraction, but on balance, we think it's typically the type of project that makes our participation in Formula One in general meaningful, not just Renault, but Renault and Nissan, but also the alliance Renault-Nissan stronger.
As we sort of look towards the next generation of Formula One rules, there's been some talk of getting rid of the MGUH in particular from the engine package, because it's been something that is so challenging to put into practice. Now, that car has two MGUHs out there, so your guys together with the Infiniti guys seem to have made it work. I mean, do you think that sort of technology is going to have a future in road cars? 5 years ago, everyone, even Andy Cowell from Mercedes, was saying, yeah, it's the future, e-turbos. We'll all have them in 5 years.
Because he developed the regulation, so he was not going to say otherwise. Well, first, I think we need to be humble and to recognize what we don't know. And you know, if you had asked some people 5 years ago if diesel was going to know the curves that we know, I think everyone would have been extremely surprised. So I think we need to accept that there is a limitation in our capacity to anticipate what the market will want, what the regulatory bodies will impose, and therefore what the technology will offer. Technology is available. MGUH technology is a possibility, but I guess that the reality of that technology will become will exist or not in accordance to also the way things are going in terms of overall regulation, in terms of overall fuel emission allowance and credit and taxation. So I think we need to accept that we don't own all of the answers to that question. But yes, there's been some discussion going back to Formula One and the more simple topic of Formula One, even though that's never that simple. But there's been some discussion about simplification of the power unit. But actually, the decision was made even though there's been some delay to the final decision on 2021 regulation. I think on the power unit, I don't expect there is any change in sight. And the reason for that, it's not necessarily because it's been a vote for MGUH, it's more that it's been a vote for stability, because we think that actually the best for the sport is stability, both in terms of cost efficiency, in terms of overall cost, but also in terms of racing. And we are finally at a stage where power units are converging or in the process of converging. So if we start again a new set of regulation, there is a risk that we open the gap again. Plus, going back to the context in which we are, there is indeed the risk that we keep on being out of sync. So Formula One making a decision that's not immediately followed by road car industry, and then Formula One making a different decision. For instance, we're moving the MGUH at a moment where maybe the road car industry is going to follow, to embrace that type of technology. I understand that there are some prototypes, there are some advanced studies, not just this one, but other ones, that take advantage of the MGUH for what it can bring to the overall fuel efficiency of the power unit and for the high level of electrification that's now on the cards for all manufacturers around the world, given the pressure on emission. So I think that's why Formula One needs to be careful not to have, you know, one of these reactions that would put it completely out of sync once again.
So,
hello.
Nico. Hello.
Good afternoon.
This will be, the sixth season you've been driving hybrid-powered Formula One cars. And the car you've been driving today here at the Salzburgring is pretty much still a prototype, but it's among the first cars to actually kind of properly bring that sort of technology to the road in terms of the MGUH and other hybrid systems. How have you found it? You've done a few laps. You seem to have been feeding back to the engineers.
It is true. It is comparable. And you can tell it's the same sort of DNA family, you know, of hybrid technology. A little bit in terms of sound, you know, you do sometimes recognize some sound bites, you know, that we find in a Formula One car, but especially I feel it when, you know, I switch through the different energy modes, like, you know, maximum deployment, maximum charge, sustainable, but especially deployment and charging, you know, the kind of different levels in power output you get, or when you charge, how much, you know, it's actually recouping. Like kind of a handbrake feeling, you know, something's gone wrong suddenly. It does compare back to the F1 technology that we find currently in these cars.
Do you think the average person on the street is ready to handle this sort of change yet, or is there going to be an education process?
There's for sure, there needs to be some educational process, but I think people that would look into this technology and buying a car like this, you know, there will be motorsport geeks, technology geeks. I think, you know, they will look for something like this because they have an interest in it, and then they will work it out and enjoy the benefits and advantages of these technologies.
Now, that car's got 400 brake horsepower just from its internal combustion engine alone, plus a 160 bhp electrical top up. Is it really that kind of, like you said, it's in terms of having the handbrake on when you lose that boost. Is it really that much of a change? Because that's
it is six
times as much power as most people have got in their road cars.
Yeah, no, 160 horsepower is a lot of horses, yeah. And you do it's a significant change when you have it or when you don't. And when you charge, it even feels like worse because what the technology is doing to maximize the charge, it feels you even have less than 400. Than just the combustion engine, but when the hybrid works, they just provide a lot of extra power, and that is the beauty and the advantage of these hybrid systems.
So that was a really interesting feature to do. The weirdest thing about the Salzburgring is that you're being driven round flat out by someone, and somewhere to your left over a fence, you see a bunch of sheep grazing in a field, which is quite weird. One of the other interesting things that Cyril said there, in terms of when I asked him about the 2021 regulations and the way some people are wanting to row back on the hybrids, particularly the MGUH, is he said that Formula One risks getting out of sync with the road car industry if it starts rowing back on some of the innovations it's made.
Yeah, I can understand that. The investment in MGUH technology has been significant, and so not surprisingly, Cyril doesn't want to see that bend, particularly when we talk about the fact that when you've got a limited amount of money and they've spent so much of that limited amount of money on the MGUH, they don't want to bend it. If you take a real step back, though, the reality is that when the new regulations were developed sort of back in 2010, 2011 for the hybrid era, the MGUH was a real techie suggestion coming from the then head of engine regulations at the FIA, and Renault really were very keen on it. I think to the outside public, whether you're running MGUK and kinetic energy systems, simply the fact that you've got a battery and electric motor is all that the public need to know. They don't really need to know how that energy is being recycled and stored. They just need to know that it's hybrid. So the MGUH, I don't think ever was promoted in the way that it should have been, and that's because the FIA, in deciding to bring that technology in, I mean, the FIA is not a marketing machine. Formula One under Bernie was not a marketing machine, so they didn't take it and run with it. So no one knew, and here we are in 2019, and I doubt anyone really knows or cares that much amongst the general public about whether Formula One has got a 110,000 RPM shaft running through the engine, producing electricity from effectively an e-turbocharger. So the whole thing was kind of a bit of technical navel gazing. Weirdly, I remember sitting in a meeting in Paris where everyone agreed that the most exciting step change was moving from port injection to direct injection, which is actually, a commonplace technology in all cars. That just never got mentioned. Now no one cares about how the fuel actually finds its way into the engine. But, the move to direct injection was much more road car relevant than the MGUH. So I think the whole thing from a regulatory point of view and then feeding through into the messaging for Formula One wasn't handled correctly. And so it ended up being something of a technical cul-de-sac.
You were involved in Cosworth kind of around about the last shift in the engine regulations, because of course Cosworth came in with the standardised engine package based on it was based on the architecture of the previous engine.
No, it was a CA. It was the same. It was exactly the same engine. It just had to be redeveloped to bring it down to the 18,000 RPM limit and also make it live a little bit longer in terms of mileage.
But you were also probably in and around some of the discussions around the hybrid. What was the appetite like around?
I was in all of the meetings to decide the hybrid engine regulations. And actually, the really weird thing about that was that the hybrid regulations were signed off at the World Motorsport Council meeting in June of 2011. We'd spent years on it, and the agreement was it was going to be an inline four with a single turbo, an MGUH, direct injection. This had been discussed for 2 years. 5 days before the World Motorsport Council meeting, I get a call from Martin Whitmarsh, then at McLaren, saying to me, oh, listen, just small point of thought we'd let you guys at Cosworth know is it's not going to be an inline four, it's going to be a V6. I said, but we've talked about that for 2 years. And he said, well, it's because of Ferrari. Ferrari have to have a multi-cylinder engine, and Renault have fallen in line with it. So the hybrid regulations, when they were signed off that following Friday at the World Motorsport Council meeting, was something that actually had only just been decided over the last 5 days. Again, for me, it was a real insight into a lack of correct governance in the way the sport constructs its regulatory frames going forward. And this is one of the reasons why, sitting here in 2019 with the 2021 regulations still not signed off, it's just horrifying. You know, time slides by and it puts teams under huge pressure, particularly the smaller teams, when there's no time to prepare for major changes.
And then, of course, it's the ones that have the massive amount of resources who can start doing these little side projects. Because I think one of the reasons that Mercedes have had such a long run of dominance is that they got working on the hybrid regulations that much earlier. They had a kind of a one-cylinder test bed running. And Andy Cowell, Ed, you've spoken to him a few times. He's an evangelist for e-turbos, isn't he? He loves the idea.
Yeah, very much so. That's a big part of the culture there. And we see Brixworth, the Mercedes engine base, they're getting involved in Formula E now. So that's an area of great interest to them. And yeah, they did commit heavily to that. I mean, I've seen they had a four-cylinder test engine that they were working on as well after the one-cylinder test bed. So they really committed to it. I think overall, the big problem Formula One has got with this is the waters get muddied, because obviously everybody has different objectives, but then you get, how important is road relevance? And road relevance is a problematic term as well, because I think people tend to think, and it sometimes gets marketed as this, that people are taking bits off Formula One cars and throwing them into road cars, which they're not. But there are development advantages to say Formula One in terms of and it's sort of extreme conditions, very, very rapid development, but also working practices and ideas and that kind of thing. That's almost more beneficial in terms of road relevance, and Honda particularly love it. They put people into their F1 engine department, then feed them back into the sort of regular automotive side. So I think what F1 needs to decide with that is, how important is it to be seen to be driving technology automotive-wise for the manufacturers? From a marketing perspective, if you're Mercedes or Renault or whatever, and you've just won a Grand Prix, as far as the man on the street goes, if you want to go down to the old, the most basic, the win on Sunday, sell on Monday, if it's a Renault, as far as they're concerned, it's Renault tech that's won. You could pay a company like Cosworth to make your engine, stick a Renault badge on it. It'll still be a Renault as far as people are concerned. So the manufacturers have to be clear about what their objectives are. And there are a lot of people around that table with you, Mark, who have, the hope was, would come into Formula One and never did, who played a part in guiding those regulations. The only manufacturer that came in was Honda off the back of these. You can argue that, say, Renault's participation was preserved by the justification of the hybrid engines as well. But it's having that clear objective. What is the engine there to do? Ultimately, it's there to make the cars go quickly, but there's huge cost attached to these things, and that's the problem with the whole governance and the regulatory side, the muddying of the waters in terms of the objectives. You can't come up with a rule set until you've got your key strategic points for what you're trying to achieve, and you cannot tick every single box as emphatically as the other. And that, I think, is where there's been a great disappointment with Formula One recently, particularly with a different leadership, that they've not been able to, in this process from the start of it, commit to their objectives and then deliver on it. It's kind of this sort of this murk of, oh well, we should do this and that, and then they decide they're going to drop the MGUH, and they say, well, actually we don't want to because we spent on it, and well, why was that decision made in the first place? There were benefits. And it's just this constant circle of underachievement in terms of the regulations.
One of the things that came over loud and clear while I was at the Salzburgring is how invested, from an engineering point of view, Infiniti were in that technology. They really enjoyed actually making that thing work. It had been long, it had been difficult. They'd had to hack the donor car apart to accommodate all these things. Cooling's been a problem because these hybrid systems throw off so much heat, and it's been a massive challenge, but their engineers love it. The marketing people actually love it as well, because they've committed to basically every powertrain is going to be electrified as of about 2021, I think. So for them, this is an absolute shoo-in. And even they're thinking, why is nobody else doing this? It's ridiculous. And Formula One's given us a great step up. We were a sponsor. Now this has become an actual key part of our offering in the showroom.
where's the automotive industry going in terms of powertrain? So it's a hybrid, which we've actually already got in Formula One. And again, no one cares how that hybrid technology works. They just need to know you've got an electric motor and batteries. And the other thing is fully electric. And I think one of the aspects of the regulation discussions for 2021 and beyond for me that ought to be on the table is the electrification story for Formula One. And of course, that's being avoided because Formula E has an exclusive contract with the FIA for 25 years, which means that if Formula One wants to go electric in the time frame of 2021 to 2030, which, by the way, is a time frame when electrification is going to completely take off, it's not in the position to do so at the moment. And Alessandro Agag, chief executive of Formula E, has repeatedly said in interviews, Formula One cannot go electric. So we're stuck with the hybrid technology. So it's good that Infiniti are using it. But, you know, let's face it, Infiniti is not what I would call a mass production mainstream manufacturer. It's a niche brand. And really, has all this money being spent on MGUHs for what is a niche product? It's very questionable.
It does need to trickle down, doesn't it? And of course, the dirty little secret of Formula E is that all the cars are charged using on-site generators that are powered by biodiesel. So really, that's a can that's just being kicked down the road, isn't it?
We should also say that the Infiniti, which is a great company, up into their technical base in the UK, great investment in Formula One. They're doing a lot, but they're not investing in Formula One as a full-on engine manufacturer, which is a whole step change. So Infiniti can get great value out of this and benefit, but they're not spending this insane amount of money that, say, a Renault is to run a team and that kind of thing. So again, while they're a good example, it's not necessarily the perfect model, because if every manufacturer was doing what Infiniti were doing, you wouldn't actually have the engines of this type, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, indeed. And there are other manufacturers who do niche stuff with electrified powertrains. You look at what McLaren are doing with the P1 supercar, which had some elements of their Formula E technology bolted onto it. But that was very much a kind of a bolted on bit that added power. It wasn't recycling quite so much energy from the powertrain. One of the interesting things for me in the sitting in the Infiniti was actually looking at that the regeneration that was going on from the heat. And it's something Nico pointed out. He thinks Formula One fans will actually enjoy seeing all these F1 derived technologies kind of working in their car. But yeah, it's an expensive way of going about it, and I'm not sure Nissan Micras will be having it anytime soon. I suppose if we move on from Renault and their various people to one of their customers who are showing them the way on the racetrack. McLaren do appear to have begun to dug themselves out of a hole. Jimmy Roberts interviewed Andreas Seidel this month, and it was fascinating. I'm sure he's a sensible enough fellow to not actually take all the credit straight away for their renaissance. But this year, McLaren seems to have got over that systemic problem they had of blaming their engine supplier and saying they had the second or third best chassis on the grid. What do you think has kind of contributed to that turnaround?
I think the key point for McLaren was parting company with Honda and then realizing it's actually our problem. And it was when McLaren finally woke up to the fact that their issue was internal, not external, and admitted that and had to go public with it, that became the turning point. You know, every counselor will tell you that, you know, when you finally admit you have a problem, you know, that's when the journey begins. And McLaren took a very long time to admit they had a problem. And then the amazing thing is the rapidity with which things have improved. It's unlocked so much of the potential that was already there. Quite frankly, the fact that Alonso moved on also has really helped, because he had become this kind of overbearing shadow across the whole team. I think he put unnecessary pressure on them. I personally feel his public humiliation of Honda contributed quite significantly to that partnership just not working. And when you look at the fact that, you know, Honda are now pairing race-winning success at Red Bull, and McLaren have rediscovered their mojo, it just begs a question. You know, was there too much pressure being put on both parties internally during the Fernando Alonso era.
I can't think of a single occasion where Max Verstappen has heaped opprobrium on the Honda powertrain when it's let him down.
No, they've been very very sensible about it. I mean, where there have been little problems, they've not been afraid to talk about them, but in a kind of constructive way. And I think the really positive thing with McLaren is that they've managed to respond to all this so effectively. They've clearly understood the extent of their problems and exactly how to fix them. And I think culture is so important there. I think on the technical side, they had a little bit of a culture of the certainty of their own superiority and things being correct. You do hear talk from within the company about it wasn't that easy to challenge the technical leadership on things. There wasn't this open culture. And Mercedes talk about, Lewis Hamilton was talking about it yesterday actually at the circuit. He was saying it's great that if there's a problem, we can go and we can talk about it. That I can say, right, this wasn't right, and we understand it. It's not this kind of blame thing. So if there are errors made, people can look to them, understand them, and then correct them. McLaren, I don't think, could do that, say, 18 months ago, whereas now, clearly they can, because what they've achieved this year is actually the most they could possibly achieve. They couldn't go higher than fourth. It's just not possible to take that bound in a single leap anymore. So huge credit to them. And I think Andreas Seidel, who in fact, yeah, he's very, very careful not to try and take credit for what's gone on, because a lot of this has been emergent from the process they've gone through. But what I think Andreas Seidel brings is very, very good focused race team leadership, and from what I understand, the ability to give, he's not trying to micromanage. It's kind of, he gives the big picture strategic leadership. He'll get involved in specific areas when he needs to, but making sure everyone knows what they're trying to do, making sure the culture is right. And that is what convinces me that McLaren actually now has a potential to, in the long term, work towards going beyond this, with the caveat that it still needs a hell of a lot of money and a lot of time to go any further than where it currently is in fourth, for the same reasons that we've talked about with Renault. But they're a customer team beating the works team. They were less competitive than the works team last year. Really, really good effort. So you can say over the past 12 months, McLaren therefore have done a significantly better job than Renault have.
There's a culture in the corporate world, isn't there, of identity. It's kind of almost a big companies fall into a panic. They decide that there's a shortcoming that they need to address by parachuting in some high-powered, highly paid executive, and then they take advantage. They take credit for any uplift, even though very often, you know, as we say, a rising tide lifts all ships. And for me, one of the most impressive things about the Andreas Seidel leadership, from what I've seen so far, is that he's been very quiet. He hasn't made waves. He's kind of learned about the culture of the organisation, but also where he's seen a shortcoming, he's been very quick to identify and do something about it. For instance, for years they've had this absurd system where they're flying over to Cologne to use the Toyota wind tunnel, and he said, okay, that has to stop. We need to, even if it means ripping part of the McLaren Technology Centre out, we need to fix our own wind tunnel and make it contemporary. So I suppose, you know, why did they persist so long with this ridiculous system of having an off-site aero research program?
The problem with the wind tunnel, and this is what is so beneficial about this leadership, is the wind tunnel is not a quick payback. It's a couple of years minimum before you've got it up and running, and even longer before you really see the benefit of that. And I think the fact that they could put that to one side and just use the Band-Aid solution tells you they weren't looking long-term, they weren't thinking properly strategically, whereas Andreas Seidel's been able to come in and say, right, that needs to be fixed. And it doesn't matter if it's going to be 2 years before it's up and running properly, 3 years before we're really feeling the full benefit of it. We need to do that. We're going to do it. And that's a huge benefit. And in that scenario, that corporate scenario you're talking about, people don't want to hear, well, we do this now and then 3 years down the line, we're going to be set. They want to hear magic bullet solutions that will work tomorrow, because that's what a certain type of poor quality corporate leadership loves to hear, that there's just some magic thing you can do rather than just do something that takes a lot of time and a lot of hard work and investment, which is what most things actually require.
Yeah, very well put. And I think the points you make about Andreas Seidel not doing this sort of egotistical, aren't I clever routine that sometimes you get from certain team principals is really important, because he's come from Porsche. And so he's come from a motorsport environment with the manufacturer where no one person could ever take the credit for the delivery. He knows that you're working within an organization. It's about organisational delivery. It's not about individual delivery. And that's a huge strength. I think his appointment is probably one of the most inspired things that Zac Brown has done since he effectively took over from Ron Dennis in the leadership of the McLaren organisation. And the benefits are already clear. And it's fantastic to see. And by the way, we should just mention the drivers, because what a breath of fresh air Lando Norris and Carlos Sainz as partners have been at McLaren. And it's created a huge sense of positivity and enjoyment. It looks like McLaren are actually enjoying themselves again. And that's great to see.
I think we discussed last week on one of the Autosport podcasts, Ed, that Carlos Sainz has pretty much made Fernando Alonso irrelevant to McLaren now, hasn't he? There's no need to call Fernando back in to rescue the ship. And also, you look at the marketing collateral they've been getting out of those two, the stuff on social they do, it just seems like a really nicely, neatly gelled driving partnership.
Yeah, it works really, really well for them. You know, Fernando Alonso is a wonderful driver. He did great things at time when the McLaren was not a competitive car, but he comes with a lot of other problems, other issues, and I think there was just almost too much focus upon the driver. You hear teams talking about, say, teams that are on the way up. You say, well, do you want to sign a superstar driver? And sometimes the teams will say, well, we're not quite actually ready for that. We don't really need that now. And almost McLaren was a lower midfield team with this star driver that just had all the attention. It just put everything into sharp focus, and keeping Alonso became this huge thing. And actually, that was the least of their worries. Wonderful driver, but yeah, I think moving on from him in Formula 1 was a good thing. In Carlos Sainz, they've got a driver who didn't have a great season with Renault last year. Actually, that's probably his least impressive season overall in Formula 1, but he's fitted in brilliantly into McLaren, which we should point out wasn't really his first choice of where he was going to be. It was kind of a, well, that's kind of my only option. Red Bull don't want me for whatever reason. Renault have decided to go down the big money superstar Ricciardo route. So Sainz ended up there, and he's done really well. And Lando Norris, a quick driver who's proved himself to be extremely, extremely able in Formula 1. So it does create this air of freshness to the team. It feels like a completely different McLaren. The old McLaren, say 12, 18 months ago, was a kind of a moribund team, sort of making a lot of noise and splashing around and not really going anywhere. Whereas now, this same organisation with 99.9% the same people, a few little changes here and there, but the same people, the same skill sets is just absolutely revitalised. And the best thing is that they'll talk about the fact that this is only one step. You know, they've done a brilliant job with that, but McLaren doesn't exist in Formula 1 to finish fourth in the Constructor Championship. If they can hold on to that, they're in a good position now. It's there to win, and that's when the really, really difficult job starts to come into play.
Yeah, Ron always used to say, second is first to the losers. So, yeah, that's not really going to work.
I presume Ron Dennis sounded a bit more like himself when he said that.
Did you?
That was one of your less impressive impressions.
So Ron Dennis has migrated into a character who's a hybrid of Ron Dennis and the photographer Darren Heath, who we refer to as Darren Dennis, and that sort of accent can be used to lampoon either of them. So
I now know that's a much more compelling version.
Yeah. And now we know what Ron Dennis sounds like with a pillow over his face. So that was quite impressive, Stuart.
So from one corporate madness to another, I think we can sort of, we've got another few minutes left before we have to sign off. A few months ago, Mark, your column was devoted to Rich Energy. You mentioned your brief dalliance with the energy drink trade while you were at Jordan, and the corporate raiders had moved in and thought there was easy money to be made. And really, over the past month or so, the Rich Energy scenario that you were writing about has kind of come to pass as you kind of thought it might have panned out. It all got a bit weird around the Silverstone weekend. It's quietened down a little bit now, but there's still no guarantee that when we come back after the summer break, the Haas cars are going to be bearing the Rich Energy logos, because we don't even know if the company as it stands exists anymore. It's completely in limbo.
Well, there's that famous phrase that someone used to use that I worked with, which is, you know, if it looks like a duck, walks like a duck, and quacks like a duck, it's probably a duck. And that's what it feels like with Rich Energy. You know, everything about it from the get-go seemed unreal. And I mean, you very kindly sent me to the livery launch for Rich Energy at the REC Club, and I went there and literally stood on the sidelines, and I just looked around. I watched the audience. I watched William Story, the chief executive. I watched the investors who were there, the people behind Rich Energy, and I stayed after the press conference, after all the media had left, just to watch the dynamic in the room, and I just thought, you know, it doesn't stack up. And that's why in that particular column that I wrote, I said, you know, you're up against a company like Red Bull. And by the way, they Rich Energy were the ones who said, we're going to beat Red Bull, which just had no credibility as a statement. Because as I said in my column, Red Bull are knocking out over 5 billion cans of energy drink a year. And you don't do that, you know, overnight. That takes a huge amount of expertise and money and effort to create. So what's been perhaps extraordinary is the degree to which it's fallen apart. It's fallen apart so quickly and fallen apart so publicly because William Story has chosen to use Twitter to basically carry out the laundering of all of their dirty washing. And it's just made for a comedy of errors. It's going down as one of Formula One's less impressive sponsorships, and I suspect it'll lead over the next months to a lot of lawyers earning a great deal of money when the court case is finally hit.
Yeah, the lawyers are going to win from this, aren't they?
Exactly, and ultimately what will decide whether it stays on the car or not is whether Haas gets some payments again, which is you know, the big question mark. They've still got a fridge full of what is apparently Rich Energy drink here in Hungary.
Yeah, so it does exist.
That's something. It does exist in very small numbers. But it's also, and Mark, you might have some insight on this. You know, Günther Steiner was talking recently about, well, it doesn't reflect badly on us, this going on, because, you know, we're the Haas racing team. We're not Rich Energy. But what's your view on how that does impact a team? The fact they've gone in, they have got some money out of them. There have been payments, so you could argue that, well, they got a little bit of money and they wouldn't otherwise have got. So that's okay. It's not their fault if the company does badly, but it's not good for a team to be seen to be involved with this sort of thing, surely.
No, absolutely. And I think the one of the points that I make in my column is that when you're selling sponsorship, one of the things you have to decide is whether that prospect is genuine, whether they're going to bring the value that you hope they're going to bring, and whether it fits in with all of your other partners. And I share a couple of stories, including famously one of America's leading purveyors of online pornography, who turned up in Formula One with a check for $10 million to sponsor a team, which was very keen to take that money. They really wanted the money. But all of the other partners said, I'm sorry, if you have a pornography company inside of the car, we will not be able to continue to support you. So the reality is that you do have to take into account the impact on the team of who you get into bed with, taking that analogy a little bit further, who you get into bed with commercially. I think what you can say about the Rich Energy program is that there's clearly been quite an intense pressure on Haas to land a sponsor, because Gene Haas cannot continue to fund a Formula One team indefinitely, and getting commercial sponsorship is so important. So they had a lot of pressure. I'm sure when William Story turned up and promised them $35 million, they were only too happy to agree to take it, and probably didn't worry too much about whether this would work out or not. That was kind of William Story's problem. But it's come off the rails so quickly. And I think Haas clearly will need to get back to digging deeper for the proper kind of commercial sponsors from corporate brands that will stand the test of time and who have credibility and who have the money to do it.
We should note, actually, that Haas weren't the only people chasing Rich Energy. Williams were chasing it, McLaren were, among others. So as soon as you
can you imagine what a sigh of relief has come out of Claire Williams in recent months. I mean, she was entertaining William Story on the grid.
Austin, I think.
Well, famously, she was due to have dinner with Story the evening of the race to kind of tie up a deal, and then suddenly the Haas deal happened. He didn't turn up, apparently.
Yeah, so I think collective sigh of relief in Grove. I mean, of all the things that Williams would not have needed on top of everything else this year, it would have been you know, livering their car in Haas, in Rich, only to discover that they didn't get paid and it was all very messy.
It was actually quite good timing, that whole Rich Energy meltdown around the pre-Silverstone weekend, because it was at that Grand Prix that Rocket Group actually announced that they were extending their sponsorship agreement. Jonathan Kendrick, one of the leaders of that organisation, was there. The money's real. They have the backing. They have product. They actually gave away a load of the new handsets that have got the fancy 3D screen, which they're hoping to do, and have actually started to do tie-ins with Hollywood studios, who've got all these films that they've made in 3D that they can show at the cinema, but then there's nothing else they can do with them. So doesn't really do them any harm to do a deal with a mobile phone provider to service that and make their legacy products available. So Jonathan Kendrick sort of had a sort of a cheeky little giggle when I asked him about the Haas scenario and said, well, you know, at the end of the day, I've made a lot of bad decisions in business. I've made fortunes. I've lost them again. It does happen, but it's all been a bit of a shower. We've come to the end of the Flat Chat podcast for another month. It's time to leave you back to your lives. Time to release Mark back to the meetings he's got in Budapest today. Is it? You don't have to come into the circuit today.
Don't even
have
to come to the circuit. I get to do business in a very nice hotel rather than at the racetrack.
That's very nice. I do like coming to the Hungaroring. Budapest is a proper world city, isn't it? It's a great European city, fantastic culture.
Yeah, it's wonderful. And actually coming here so many years after we first turned up in Hungary in the 1980s, and it was behind the Iron Curtain at that time, and I have a distinct recollection of flying into the airport with in 1990 with Martin Donnelly, who was then racing for Lotus. And we went to the hire car desk, and there was only one hire car company, and you had a choice of two cars. It was a Lada 1300 or a Lada 1600. And all the Formula One drivers were going for the Lada 1600s. And Martin Donnelly was saying to me, this is just a great world we live in. He had parked his Lotus Esprit Turbo at Heathrow Airport and was now clambering on board a Lada 1600 to see how much he could wring its neck on the way to the Hungaroring. And then to watch how this country has changed and the city has changed and the popularity of this race. And it's just a fantastic event to come to.
Some of the road surfaces haven't changed that much, as we discovered on intimate acquaintance with the bump stops of our Suzuki hire car as we drove five up to the circuit yesterday. Ed, are you going to be able to select the right junction and get in the FIA lane on the M3 today?
I make no promises. I make no promises about whether I may need to do U-turns over tram tracks if that's quicker. But we will get there.
You didn't go around the cones in the wrong direction and incur a penalty, did you?
Oh well, yeah, the wrong side of the bollard. Yeah, that's a criminal offence.
Absolutely. I don't think the marshals weren't watching. There was someone laying out another cone there actually, who looked at us a bit funny.
We've actually discovered that going around the bollard the wrong side is a worse offence than unsafe release in a pit lane full of mechanics, which interests me. Although they have changed that,
they've rode back on that, and that was quite a disgrace at the time, wasn't it? So I'm pretty glad that the FIA have clarified that they're not going to levy any more penalties. That was Leclerc at Hockenheim, wasn't it? They were fined
with Grosjean. Yeah, they only fined them, and I think
it was change, wasn't it, for a multi-million-dollar car company?
Exactly, leniency on track where everything's designed to be hit, but in the pit lane where you've got lots of mechanics and that kind of thing, I think you need to make sure that there's a very, very high penalty so nobody's tempted to take a risk.
Very, very definitely. So thank you to both my guests, our star columnist Mark Gallagher.
Thank you.
And Ed Straw. This is where you say thank you, Ed.
Thank you. I was just wondering whether I've been excluded from star columnist.
You are again. A star columnist, Ed. You are the F1 analyst.
Star columnist Mark Gallagher and some other bloke.
Some other bloke borrowed from Autosport.
Exactly. That's fair. I'll accept that. Mark's achieved an awful lot. So there's worse people to be behind.
You learn an awful lot from reading Ed's column, which will be, is it Carlos Sainz this month or is that next month?
I think it's Carlos Sainz this month, yes. And you might find me delving into the world of Haas next month.
Oh, that's going to be great. So also in the latest issue of F1 Racing, out now, we interview Kimi Raikkonen. He speaks. He's quite effusive. I don't know how Jimmy managed that. Jimmy has also been speaking to a number of former F1 drivers and test drivers on what it's like to drive an absolutely abysmal Formula One car when you're hopefully on your way up the F1 grid and you get stalled in the what some people describe as a shit box. I don't. And we also take an in-depth look at a car that you would not use that phrase to describe. The Brabham BT49 is the subject of Now That Was a Car this month. So I've been Stuart Codling. This has been Flat Chat. The producer was Martin Lee. We'll see you again next month.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting 3 matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep their trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.